usually last day of a conference, I'm tired and sleepy, except if I'm giving a talk, then I wake up. But you're not. So I hope I can keep it alive and entertain you. Where I really want to get at is the end of the life of black hole, because I think it's a problem in quantum gravity. It's a physical situation in quantum gravity, which everybody who has a think about quantum gravity should think about it. And I don't think it's much studied, if it is studied at all. However, since somehow we are here, and Nyayesh's idea is to bring together different different communities, I will use the first 10-15 minutes to as an introduction to quantum gravity, aimed both at those of you who don't have a view of quantum gravity, but also my colleagues. Loop quantum gravity is not a communist party with a party line and everybody says the same thing it should follow. It's the opposite. It's a collection of a quite large number of people who have different ideas, different views. So this is my take on where the theory is right now. One version of the theory is right now, which is not everybody's is not everybody's view. All right. So I thought of introducing loop quantum gravity in a starting from something which is familiar, which is just classical general relativity, and a version of formulation of general relativity, which is a nice entry point to the theory, which is, as I'm going to show you in a moment, general relativity can be condensed in two equations, these two blue equations here. Well, this is the action of a topological field theory without local degrees of freedom, plus a constraint on the B, which is a very simple form and an intriguing geometrical and physical interpretation. So let me just very rapidly show how one gets there. This is the actual generativity you'll know in terms of the metric. From the metric, you know one can go to tetrads. If you have tetrads, you can have a connection as a dual variable, which can be related to the tetrad or not. This is an SL2C connection. If you take a tetrad and the connection as independent variables and you write this action, this gives the Einstein equations, right? This gives two equations. One is the relation between tetrad and spin connection. The other is the Einstein equation. Now, you can add to this equation this term here without the star. The star is the Hodge dual and the Turner indices, the epsilon ij kl. And this term does not change the equation of motion, so has no effect on the classical theory. So this is still, this whole section is still an action for general relativity. However, that terms affect the quantum theory. It's a similar thing in QCD, right? There's a term with a different parity which affects the quantum theory but not the classical theory. Now, this action here, if you bring together F and define EE wedge, you bring the wedge on the other side, plus 1 over gamma EE, can be written in this form, where B has this form. And if you take B as the independent variable, you get a topological theory. This is a GR if B is constrained to have a form such that there is an E, right? So a generic B cannot be written in this form. There is no E there. But there is a way of expressing the constraint of E to be on B to be on this form, which is interesting, this one, which is the following. This is a four dimensional. So take a constant time, a time-like surface, and think this is the boundary of the four-dimensional space-time region you're studying. And on the boundary, there is the geometrical normal, the one form. The thing is defined without the metric. Since you have a tetrad, you can bring it to internal indices, and this allows you to gauge fix SL2C, this SL2C there, to SU2, obviously, right? If you're on a boundary, you have a preferred reference frame. So you have a preferred Lorentz frame, so you can just gauge fix it to say being this frame and just have SU2. If you do that, B has two, is a two-form, but has two internal indices because there are indices up here. So it's like F mu nu, the Maxwell field. And the Maxwell field, if you choose a frame, you can split into vectors, the electric field and the magnetic field, right? So since here we have a frame, you can write the analog of the electric and magnetic field for B, okay, which is called K and L, which are two vectors. And now it turns out, it's a little bit of algebra, it's a little theorem, that if this is satisfied, so if K is proportional to L with this constant gamma, then there is an E such that B can be written in this form, then and only then, okay? So therefore, this is generativity, this and this. Now this, as I said, is a topological field theory, is easy to quantize. This is a very interesting equation, and let me tell you something about this equation because it's super intriguing. Take again a four-dimensional region of space-time, okay, bounded by sort of an initial time-like, space-like slide and a final one, and look what happened at the corner, okay? The corner is a two-dimensional thing, right? Now, a two-dimensional thing is a surface has an area element, and the area element is precisely E wedge E, and if you just work out a little bit, I'm not writing all the indices, that's exactly the L which is there, which is a vector. You have a two-dimensional thing, you have the vector normal to it. So this is L. What about K? Well, if you're here, there are two frames attached to it, the one of the past and the one of the future surfaces. So there is a Lorentz transformation that takes one into the other, right? That's called the modular Hamiltonian that move you up. Well, K is, if you view it, if you think K is a dual to the, is a canonical conjugate to the connection. If you think electromagnetism was a canonical conjugate to the Maxwell potential is electric field, which in terms of Poisson bracket is a generator of the gauge transformation, okay? So the components of B, both of these are components of the of SL to C transformation. So L is a sort of rotation, is a rotation that keeps the surface in itself, and K is a corresponding boost. So if this surface in coordinate is this XY coordinate, the boost is in the ZT. So that equation is telling you that the modular Hamiltonian at the corners is the area. So this is general relativity. General relativity is a topological field theory with a constraint which says that the modular Hamiltonian at corners is the area. That's one entry point to loop quantum gravity. Now let's start to tell you how quantum gravity is constructed. It's a quantum theory, so it's defined by Hilbert space, some operators, some transition amplitudes. And the way to think about it, let's go back to this picture here, is that what we are studying in loop quantum gravity is not the universe as a whole, is not something seen from infinite distance, it's a finite region of space-time. So it's a finite region of space-time in which there is an initial state of matter and geometry and a final state of matter and geometry, and we have equations that give the transition amplitude for one to the other. Right? So the states are in some Hilbert space, and there are operators that represent, well, if there's matter, also matter, but if there's no matter, just a geometry, so the tetrad, essentially, triad, because we're gauge fixed, and then we have transition amplitudes. Now, the key idea for constructing loop quantum gravity in the covariant way that I'm describing is that it is defined via truncation. And I want to insist that truncations are always used in quantum field theory, in the quantum field theories that we do physics with, in the real quantum field theory. And that's crucial, and I think it's a source of misunderstanding for what I'm going to say after, so I want to spend a second here. There are two ways we do calculation in quantum field theory for real. One is Feynman graphs, and the other is lattice QCD. Feynman graphs, all calculations up to some order, is ordered by order, they always involve up to n particles. So they're always calculations in the subspace of Fock space, which have particle up to n number of particles, which is a finite number of degrees of freedom. all calculations that we do final number of degrees of freedom. The theory has all possible degrees of freedom, of course, but every single transition amplitude is computed this way. And in lattice gauge theory, it's the same thing. I mean, people do now compute the mass of the hadrons on a finite lattice, okay, being convinced that if you refine the lattice, nothing changes. So the same happens in loop quantum gravity. The Hilbert space is defined up to a certain truncation, and then you can do the truncation more and more as you want. And the truncation can be thought as a cellular decomposition of the three-dimensional surfaces on which the state are defined, and are usually represented in the dual. So if it's a triangulation, this is a tetrahedron, more in general, this is a cell, and the line says which cell is next to which. And also, the transition amplitudes are defined truncation, sequence of truncations, where again you can think of the triangulation of the bulk, and they usually represent in the dual. So this is a four cell, four simplex if it's a triangulation. This is a three cell, a tetrahedron, and the surfaces are the dual of the faces of the triangulation, which is the triangulation. All right, and this you can think in two ways, just to give you the intuition. Think of this as quanta of space, and the line says who is next to whom. And this can be thought in two different manners, either of a history of quanta of spaces, a la Feynman, Feynman graph or histories of quanta, how they get together, or, like in lattice gauge theory, a discretization of space-time. And the beauty is that once you go to gravity, the two things becomes one. Because the discretization of space-time is a history of the pieces of space-time that go together. This to help the intuition. Now, before actually giving the...
Can you go back to the previous slide? The Hilbert space, what are the...
I'm going to say the, what is the Hilbert space in a moment.
Okay, what are the variables?
Yeah, I'm going to say it. In, I just said what are the ingredients. I'm going to say what... explicitly what they are. But before doing that, we'll do it in a couple of slides, write explicitly variables in the Hilbert space. But before doing that, I want to say something about the truncation, which I think it's a crucial technical thing on which, in my opinion, loop quantum gravity relies, which is the following. If you do truncations suitably, in a diffeomorphic invariant theory, something completely different happens than if you do in a non-diffeomorphic invariant theory. And to show this, take just a simple harmonic oscillator, okay, discretize it, which is a truncation of degrees of freedom in some sense, and write the propagator, so the matrix element of the unitary evolution operator, as a path integral discretized, so it's a multiple integral. And if you do it explicitly, you see immediately that you need to recover the continuum things, you need two limits. You need the number of steps to infinity, but also the lattice spacing A to zero, which you can reabsorb in omega in the coupling constant or in the frequency here, and send the coupling constant to a critical point, okay? This is why lattice QCD, you have to send the lattice spacing to zero or the beta to zero, right? You have to go to the critical point. But look what happens, and this is magic. If you take the same theory and you write it in a parameterized form, so you take time and you promote it to a variable, right? And you introduce a general coordinate tau, which is theories of repetition invariant. Look what happened. You do the same thing, but magic, magic, the lattice space is canceled, disappears. So therefore, whatever you do at the end of the day, you just have one limit to take. And that's the reason for which the Wilson action of lattice QCD has a lattice spacing, but the Regge action of discretized GR doesn't have a lattice spacing. It's it. So the truncation is only in the number of degrees of freedom. It's not in a scale or anything like that. All right. So let me, last thing before going to the actual equations of loop quantum gravity, how do we quantize a theory like a topological field theory like this one? There are many ways. This is one of the many, again, using a truncation. Formally, the partition function of that is just obtained by integrating on the two variables. But since it's a linear in B, you can do explicitly the B integral, you get a delta. And so you get this very well-known formula. You get sort of the integral on the connection of the flat connections, the deltas of the flat connections. If you discretize and somehow you put connections on lines, it becomes a group element, and the delta is on the closed sequences of lines. And just changing variables a little bit, you can put the group variables on these wedge lines here, and you can write the partition function in this form, where you have a delta when you go around the face, and then a vertex amplitude which glues things together, which is a little algebra can be written in this form. This is not very important, because it's I'm going to give you the formula for loop quantum gravity in a moment. This is missing, of course. Okay? So how do we bring k equal l inside? Remember, the game is that the theory is locally SL to C invariant, okay? But gauge fixed on the boundary to SU2. So this is SU2 SL to C game. Now, just a slide of representation theory of SL to C and SU2. Unitary representation of SU2 are labeled by a spin. You all know unitary representation of SL to C, careful, these are the infinite dimensional representation, right? SL to C is non-compact. Are labeled by a half integer and a continuous number. Now, the following is true, and is a technical thing on which this theory relies. Among this representation labeled by that, those that satisfy this relation between k and u, okay, this relation here, have a subspace. The subspace is when j equal k, okay, where k is gamma l, where k and l are the generator of the boost and rotation generator of SL to C. Furthermore, the subspace is, well, this is pretty obvious because SU2 is a subspace of SL to C, are they transform under SU2 naturally. So this is a natural map from SU2 representation and the subspace of those SL to C representations. Okay? And this allows me, to write the transition amplitudes of loop quantum gravity by taking the previous formula for the topological field theory and replacing the vertex amplitude that I had before, which was all SU2 for SU2 BF theory. With a something that makes it invariant locally under SL to C, because I have a map that brings me from SU2 to SL to C, and I can integrate it there. So locally, k equal gamma l is implemented. The theory is locally gauge invariant, SL to C gauge invariant, and I have an explicit definition of the transition amplitude. This is without matter. This is the definition of the transition amplitude, entire, exact. This is without matter and without cosmological constant. Adding matter is easy. Adding, say, Young-Mills or fermions is easy. Adding a cosmological constant is complicated, but is done. Mathematics becomes quite more complicated. By the way, here, Laurent Fidel was one of the people that put this into shape. Now, Robert, what about the Hilbert space? Well, I go to the boundary of this thing here. On the boundary of the sort of two complex, I have the graph. And the variables are SU2 group elements on each of these lines. So the states are just a wave function of this group elements, which are suitably SU2 invariant at the nodes. Okay, so this is the Hilbert space. Okay, it's L2 with a Haar measure, of course, of L is the number of links, invariant under SU2 to the N, where N is the number of nodes. This gamma, because it tells which one are the invariants, which one is the invariants here. There are operators here, well, the group elements themselves, but the dual are the triad, the group elements is the exponentiation of the connection, the dual are the triad. So we know the interpretation of this operator here, which is sort of the left invariant vector field of the group. And these individual operators, which are on associated to a node and a link, are not gauge invariant, but it's easy to write gauge invariant operators, and they have an immediate interpretation in terms of the geometry of this sort of quanta of space, because they are the, you just do explicitly the classical generativistic formulas for the geometry. And this thing here are the areas of the faces and the angles between the faces. So these are operators. And the main result of canonical loop quantum gravity, of course, is that you can write a spectral, you can do the spectral analysis of these operators, and you find that they have discrete spectrum. This is a spectrum of the area. The spectrum of the volume is just more complicated to write it down, but you can write it down and compute it. So you have a quantum geometry on the boundaries, which is quantum careful in three different sense. First of all, the eigenvalues are discrete. Careful. The quantum discretization of loop quantum gravity is not that there is a triangulation. This is just an approximation. You can't, if you could make the triangulation arbitrarily fine and have arbitrarily small things, you would recover the continuum. The quantization, the quantum quantization, is that there is a minimal area and a minimal volume. So eigenvalues are discrete. Furthermore, if you just look explicitly, the operators do not commute, so the geometry of these individual things is not sharp. They are like the angular momentum of an electron, right? They don't commute. So an electron is not really a rotating particle. So these are not really geometrical things classically, because the angle, the different angles represented by operators don't commute with one another. One could do a coherent state theory. There's a large body of literature. Laurent has done a lot about that. Which write the in this Hilbert space here, the states that represent for large j sort of smooth geometries. But generically, a generic state is a quantum superposition of geometries, of course. So this is the theory, that's all. The main results are, first of all, that this vertex amplitudes in some suitable limit, and there's a long decade of discussions on that, which are continuing until recently with some numerical work to clarify something. I'm not going into the long details. There's a large number of results that indicate that the classical limit could well be general relativity. It goes back to Barrett and other, and to original paper by Conradi Friedel, which was one of the first indications in that direction. It continues until recently, some numerical thing. So there's no solid mathematical proof that you can get the Einstein equation, but there are all sorts of indications. What is the point? You have this transition amplitude. You want to show that the transition amplitude, given initial three geometry, four geometry, goes to the Hamilton-Jacobi function of general relativity, which is analogous to knowing the Einstein equations. And then the main thing is, of course, that is, this is finite. Or more precisely, there are no ultraviolet divergences in the amplitudes that I wrote down, but there are infrared divergences. If you do the version with the cosmological constant, positive cosmological constant, there are no ultraviolet divergences. There are no infrared divergences either. So the transition amplitudes are completely finite. The boundary represent classical geometries and discrete classical geometry. And I already mentioned that in, you're good, this was fast enough. So I can go to black holes. Let me just say this, so then I close the loop quantum gravity part and I take questions. I said this already of course we have no observation confirming loop quantum gravity, I don't need to say that. But at the very least, there's no supersymmetry, which was suggested by string theory. There's a positive cosmological constant instead of the negative cosmological constant everybody seems to like, except the good Lord. And the no Lorentz invariance violations predicted by Ojava theory. And of course, if you couple, say, electromagnetism, you get the Maxwell-Einstein equation. So the speed of gravitational waves is the same as speed of electromagnetic waves, contrary to most alternative to GR predicted. So that's what I wanted to say about loop quantum gravity before going to black holes.
So,
Robert.
I have a basic question. Where are the loops here? So it looks similar to Reggie Kaplan, so it's a discretized version of canonical gravity. I was missing the loops.
Oh, the loops is just historical. There's like strings in string theory. I mean, they're not really strings. They're all sort of...
You could have just never mentioned loop.
I could have never mentioned loop. A spin network state, which is lives on this graph, I mean, going backward, you can decompose it in a sum of state, each one which is... If you take the spin J representation, you decompose this spin 1/2 on the nodes they are rerouting. So you can write it as a sum of products of loop states, each one of which in the connection representation, if you do a sort of form of Fourier transform to the connection representation, is the holonomy of the connection in spin 1/2. So you can trace back as the old loop states that originated all that. They're still there. But it's a funny basis, the loop one. So you might forget the loops and still have them.
Well, Carlo, maybe a way to point to a difference that is a difference not just with Reggie calculus but also with other approaches to quantum gravity is the fact that we work with group variables, and these group variables are such that if you look at position and momentum, the momentum variable needs to be quantized a la loop. So the holonomy of the connection and the connection itself.
Yeah, so there's a group element here. The loop is you go from here to here to close back, and then you have the holonomy, the product of this loop is that's a leftover of the original loops. Let me go to black holes. Because that's what I wanted to get at. How are we doing with time? Okay. All right, so what do we know about black holes? Real black holes in the sky. This is what classical general relativity tell us. A star collapses and horizon form. This is what quantum field theory in curved space-time tell us. There's Hawking radiation, which goes there and, of course, falls in. And there's Hawking radiation inside as well. When is this picture not reliable? Well, almost for sure there, because the curvature becomes Planckian. But, and that's what I want to stress, if there's Hawking radiation, this horizon here shrinks, becomes small. And outside the horizon, the curvature goes as 1 over the radius of the horizon square. So the curvature outside the horizon becomes Planckian near the end of the Hawking evaporation, which means that you are deep in a quantum gravity region outside the horizon here, which everybody seems to forget. I mean, maybe I'm saying something completely trivial, which means that everything that happens after that is determined by quantum gravity. So if you assume that after nothing happens and you're back to, say, Minkowski, you're making an assumption about quantum gravity, which might be right or wrong. But you're making an assumption about quantum gravity. And I think it's wrong. I don't know, but I think it's wrong. So what we really don't know is this part, including the distant future of Scry plus. So it might well be that this happens, the poof, geometry of TED. This was a picture in Stephen Hawking, old. But this is an assumption about the quantum gravity physics here, which might be completely ungrounded. Another alternative is that from Scry you can see the quantum transition, and if you believe a sort of a cosmic censorship conjecture, and you apply it in reverse, you evolve from here before going to quantum sense, as you expect to have an horizon. So that's a possible alternative to this one. There are others, right? There's a quantum universe that forms or whatever. But that's certainly a possibility. And that's a possibility I want to explore. And I also would like to explore whether this or this is right using a theory, not using fancies. Oh, I would like that, but using a theory. Now, this is an interesting possibility for a number of reasons. I want to get back at the end. If it takes m cube in Planck unit, m being the mass of the collapsing thing, to evolve, to get to the end of the evaporation, if there's a quantum transition, there's a good reasons to expect that the resulting white hole has a much longer, at least an m-fourth time life, because all the information which is inside has to go out, and this is small. You need a long time for having. I'm squeezing here long arguments. So there might be long-living remnants, and I'll show you that moment that classical GR is compatible with that, and then the question is what quantum gravity tells us about. And this, as I will argue, are a very interesting candidate for dark matter. All right, so is this possible? And the answer is, let me think about classically before going to the quantum theory. Surprisingly, yes, because there is a metric for this space-time where there is a star that collapses and bounces, an horizon, then a quantum region here, a white hole horizon here, a trapped region, an anti-trapped region. There's an explicit metric that one can write down, which is pretty simple, actually, and it's very beautiful. The metric of the star here, this is a Penider-Schneider model of the star, corrected by quantum gravity exactly in the way in loop quantum cosmology the correction of the Friedman equation that is studied in loop quantum cosmology. Francesca will say something about that. So in loop quantum gravity in cosmology suggests that if you go back, you go to a maximum density and then you bounce back. If you do the same thing here, the star bounces. And outside, a simple correction to the Schwarzschild solution, where A is essentially H bar, so it's a correction that only affects the deep small r region, gives this geometry here. This geometry here can be written explicitly in UV coordinates. I'm using too much time, so I don't want to go into detail. So we have a geometry here that give exactly this this physics, which is essentially a solution of Einstein equation outside in the black hole and in the white hole. Okay? It's very surprising. And let me give you an intuition about the shape here. What is going on? A good foliation to think about is that take a sort of constant time slice, but get to the horizon, okay? And then inside, choose the maximum volume one, right? If you have a sphere in Minkowski, what you call the volume inside is the maximum volume because all the others are smaller by Lorentz. So this is a good foliation. As time goes by, it goes closer and closer here, right? It starts here and goes up. And what's the three-dimensional geometry of that? Well, outside is this flat thing, and then there is a horizon, and then you have a long tube, which as time goes on become smaller in the angular direction and longer in the radial direction. And careful, because this is a constant source of confusion. The singularity is not here. Here there's a star falling in. The singularity is there. So the right intuition of black hole is not that there is a singularity in the center, is that there is a star in the center, and the singularity is when this shrinks to become very small, okay? So what happened in the metrics that I described? Well, it becomes very, very small, you get to maximal density, and then it comes back. The white hole is just a time reversal black hole. Good. Skip this. Yeah, I don't. I'll kind of use all my time. So I want to go to the quantum part, because this is where I wanted to get at. So all the outside is classical, this is a quantum part. So how can we tackle that with loop quantum gravity? Well, we can do an ab initio calculation in quantum gravity by truncating, so by replacing this with a finite number of degrees of freedom and the interior. We have a state here, and we have a transition amplitude here. We have the formulas explicitly, we can just compute. Now, outside, I treat it as classical. And that's, I think, the sort of message I want to do it. When we do quantum mechanics, we have a system and we have the outside. Whether you use a Copenhagen interpretation, many-world, relational, you are always, when you talk about values of things, even in many-world interpretation, you split in two, and the values come in a branch, because some variables have a value in a branch. So you always have to split in two. So here you're describing this quantum process as seen from the outside. Think Copenhagen, you measure here, you measure there, and you have a probability. Okay? Now, calculation can be done. And what can be computed? I can ask the probability if I see this metric here, and then I do immediately after another measurement of the geometry here, whether it is this one or this one, which is the analog of doing quantum tunneling, right? I have a particle that comes in, can be either bounce or reflect. And I can fix the energy here, and I have a transition and reflection coefficients that I can compute as function of the energy. Calculation can be done, it's a complicated thing, it was done some time ago. For a while, that's a main part of the result. For a while, I was very confused by that, because m is the mass of the star here, m Planck, and this alpha depend on the coherent state that you put here, which I found it very confusing at the beginning, but it's exactly right, because this is exactly what happened if you have a wave packet here. The wave packet that have an average energy, but of course, depending on the shape of the wave packet, since the transition and reflection coefficients depend on the energy, you have a different probability of going through. So for long I thought this was nonsense, but it's not nonsense, that's correct. And if I take this seriously, what is this telling me? That the probability amplitude is completely suppressed as long as the mass of the black hole is much larger than the Planck mass. Careful, this is a non-perturbative thing, right? 1 over e to the 1 over h bar. So this means that, now I bring back the full physics, the Hawking radiation. As long as the mass is large, this is not what's going to happen. But when the mass becomes Planckian, this might happen. So what is relevant of this calculation is not the full space-time, it's only the transition here, which might describe what happened in this moment here. And what about after? What about here? Careful. This is a white hole. So this we are in classical general relativity here as a white hole, but white holes are unstable. So what could happen? And here again, I think quantum gravity is crucial, because white holes are unstable in the sense that they have a finite, they can become black holes, right? That's the instability of white holes. It's not that they dissipate, they become black holes. But remember, there is an error gap. It's the main result of quantum gravity. So if there is no transition amplitude, a very small transition amplitude to go to Minkowski, to zero, okay, you have to stay at some mass. And so you have a lot of quantum numbers which correspond to the inside, but you have a quantum number that says if you're a black hole or white hole, and you have a probability of going from black to white, the probability of going to white to black. And quantum mechanics tell us what happened in these cases, right? It's a two-level system with a Hamiltonian, which you diagonalize, the system sits on the minimum of the Hamiltonian. So what the theory predicts is that this is stable formally as a linear combination of black and white. And this stable particle have a mass which is given by the area gap, there's a minimum, which is a microgram. And there is quite some literature, which I don't have time, I just mentioned that there is, exploring whether these little things, black hole remnants stabilized by quantum gravity, could be a component of dark matter. It's a candidate to dark matter that doesn't require any new physics, no correction of Einstein equations, no supersymmetry, no anything that haven't been. So that's my summary. First, loop quantum gravity is a tentative theory of perturbative quantum, or non-perturbative quantum gravity, can be used to study quantum gravitational phenomena. There's calculation that one can do for studying them under a number of hypotheses. One is that this truncation makes sense. Second, black holes can die quantum tunneling to white holes, stabilize your quantum gravity. I think yesterday Ted Jacobson mentioned the possibility that he likes the idea of the interior to poof away.
I think it's Ted, isn't it?
And what I want to say is that in principle, this can be computed, loop quantum gravity. I just put another future thing and compute the transition to something else. And finally, I am deep in my heart, I think this is very likely, but I don't have strong evidence for that. These long-living remnants are possible dark matter candidates. I'm not going into complicated cosmological discussion about that, how they fit with the rest of cosmology, they should be pre-Big Bang or whatever. But they're beautiful dark matter candidates, super beautiful, because it's very hard to prove them wrong, because they're very hard to detect. Stop here.
Yeah, I think it's a question channeled by the phone call of Ted. Now you can quantum in that model. You could also compute the amplitude for doing proof.
Yeah, exactly.
And then compare. So
exactly.
Which one is the most probable?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly. Absolutely. So the point is that...
Within the context of your model, we could decide maybe it's more probable to poof or to do that.
Exactly, exactly. In fact, that's something to be done, for sure.
Thank you. If you guys want to catch a drink break. Thank you.